We'll hear argument first today in case 07588, Entergy Corporation versus Riverkeeper Incorporated and the consolidated cases. Mr. Josepher?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, for more than 30 years, EPA has construed the Clean Water Act to permit it to consider the relationship between costs and benefits in setting limits on water intake. The Court of Appeals' unprecedented limitation of that discretion is wrong as a matter of basic Chevron interpretive principles for at least three reasons. First, the controlling statutory standard, which looks to the best technology available for minimizing adverse environmental impacts, is ambiguous and does not preclude EPA's interpretation, especially in light of the statute's other best technology provisions, two of which expressly require consideration of the relationship between costs and benefits. Second, there's no indication that Congress determined for itself that the benefits of stricter regulations would, in fact, outweigh their costs. Instead, from both the context — I'm sorry, there's no indication in either the context or the history of the statute that Congress determined for itself that the benefits of stricter regulations would, in fact, justify their costs. Instead, the indication is that Congress left that to the agency. Congress took a very careful look at the separate issue of the discharge of pollutants and legislated numerous very specific provisions concerning the discharge of pollutants. But when it came to water intake, Congress gave scant attention to that at all and included only this one very general provision in the Act on that subject.
Of course, in the other provisions, it specifically required consideration of costs and benefits, and it didn't do so in this provision.
Right. In our view, that strongly supports our view that, first, Congress understood that consideration of costs and benefits was not incompatible with the application of a best technology standard. Otherwise, it would not have required that consideration as part of best technology standards, which seems to show at a minimum that a best technology standard does not unambiguously foreclose consideration of the relationship between costs and benefits.
May I ask you to follow up on that? Because when your statement about compatibility raises what, for me, is a fundamental difficulty in understanding this case. And I think my difficulty goes both to Chevron Step 1 and Step 2. And that is this. I think we all start from the premise that whatever else subsection B had in mind, it was imposing some kind of a technology-driven standard criterion. It's there in the words. The difficulty that I have is if you are going to apply on at least a site-specific basis a cost-benefit analysis, I'm not sure how it would work. In other words, it seems to me that when you're talking about the possible harm from pulling in a few fish or a few plankton or a few baby clam larvae and so on, as against the cost conceivably of millions of dollars for extending intake pipes or putting expensive filtering mechanisms, you're dealing with such incommensurables that I don't know how, on a site-specific basis, you would sensibly apply a cost-benefit analysis. You know, are 1,000 plankton worth $1 million? I don't know. And my difficulty then is I don't know how it would work. And because I don't know how it would work, it seems to me that if you're going to apply a cost-benefit analysis, the odds are what you're going to do is basically eliminate the whole technology-driven point of the statute. So that's my difficulty. Can you help me out on that?
Yeah, 2 points on that. The first is that this is how it's always been done. I mean, since 1977 at least, first, permitting decisions have always been done on a facility-by-facility, case-by-case basis.
Do we know, so far as intake pipes are concerned? I mean, maybe I'm being foolish in thinking it's a little easier to make sense of it when we're talking about toxic discharges. But leaving that aside, do we know that with respect to these kind of intake technology decisions, that the cost-benefit analysis has been in any way sensible? In other words, maybe what Congress had in mind was this just doesn't work doing it on a site-specific cost-benefit analysis, and that's why we're going to pass subsection B in the first place. So you say, well, we've had experience with cost-benefit analysis. What's the experience?
Sure. Well, I guess now I have 3 points.
Yeah.
The first is that The first is that the history here is, in that I was referring to, is with respect to cooling water intake structures, where for more than 30 years, cooling water intake structures have been determined on a case-by-case basis, where EPA determined as early as 1977 and ever since that it would be unreasonable to impose, to require the use of technology whose costs are wholly disproportionate to its benefits.
And if so these have been applications of something more than the outside standard, which I guess everybody agrees would apply in a case like this, that when it just becomes wholly or outrageously disproportionate, there would in that sense be a cost-benefit cutoff. Well, these have been more subtle decisions than that.
Yes, and I mean, just the phrasing of the standard, whether costs are wholly disproportionate to benefits itself indicates that there is a comparison here.
Sure.
And we cite in our brief, one particular, in our reply brief, one specific example where benefits were clearly not de minimis.
But the Second Circuit recognized that latter kind of taking account of costs, disproportionate more than the industry would bear. And they also recognized a cost comparison. If you have a cheaper method that is almost as good, you can use that, and you don't have to use the one that will capture the extra fish. So everybody agrees that there is some consideration of cost. The question is how much, and the concern is, as Justice Souter said, that you're comparing things that aren't comparable.
Well, first off, I'm sorry. I guess one basic point is just that first off, in terms of the Court of Appeals recognition that costs and benefits could be compared in extreme circumstances, that just deprives it of the logic of its position. Because when we talk about the extent or degree or manner to which a permissible consideration can be considered, that's a classic matter for the agency's gap-filling discretion. It's not something for the Court of Appeals or the respondents to get discretion on. And second, in terms of the concern, the cost-benefit analysis can be difficult because we're comparing benefits that are not easily monetized to economic costs. That's just systematically the case with all cost-benefit analyses, either ones which people do in ordinary life. When I decide whether to buy a TV for this amount or a more expensive TV for a different amount, I don't know exactly how in my head I quantify that, but I do. And with respect to the cost-benefit...
Isn't it easier to quantify that than the value of a plankton?
But with cost-benefit analyses, again, this is routinely done by agencies. The statisticians,
no, it is. I will grant you that agencies purport to do this kind of thing. But my question, and I think Justice Ginsburg's question, is: does it make any sense in these circumstances to think that you really can do a cost-benefit analysis? And if the answer is no, we've been purporting to do it, but it really doesn't make a lot of sense, then it either means that there's just going to be an irrational process going on, or it means that the technology-driven standard basically is going to be read right out of the statute, because you're always going to find some disproportion which is going to limit your use of technology.
No, I think the most irrational thing would be to just throw up one's hands and say that we're going to impose standards whether or not they do more harm than good, whether or not they make any sense. And here, I mean, the agency very carefully considered the relative costs and the relative benefits, and also did so in a way that puts a thumb on the side of the environmental side of the scales.
Just to get back to your television hypothetical, if you told somebody that you were going to buy the best TV available, nobody would think you meant that, you know, you were going to buy a very cheap TV because, considering the cost and benefits, that was the best one. They would think you're going to get, you know, the fanciest TV you could.
Well, these words have different meanings in different contexts, which just underscores their ambiguity. But taking the phrase here as a whole, if I said I was going to acquire the best technology available for winterizing my lawnmower so that it would still work again in the spring, the best technology available for winterizing a $400 lawnmower would not be a $500 fluid. Because when one's talking about protecting something, it's intuitive to think about the value of what's being protected. And again, Congress, by expressly requiring cost-benefit analysis for some of the pollution discharge limits, was expressly contemplating exactly what seems to concern you.
Does it make any difference?
The cost would be traded against.
You have the two labels, BPT, best practical, and then best available. And isn't it so that the best available technology, even thinking of the Clean Air Act, what they call BACT, is considered the most technology-forcing standard, and then there are lesser standards, but you seem to think that these can be synonyms.
All of these words can have different meanings. I think of the four best technology provisions that are expressly cross-referenced in this provision, the one that's most informative here is the best conventional pollutant control technology. Because Congress expressly required cost-benefit consideration in determining the best conventional pollutant control technology. And best is the only word in that phrase that, that is amenable to a cost-benefit reading.
Well, I think maybe what Justice Ginsburg was beginning to get at is my question here. I assume that BTA is the most rigorous of the standards set forth in the statute. And you can argue with that assumption, but then grant me the assumption for the moment. If BTA is more rigorous than the other standards, what is it in the regulations that reflects the agency's concurrence with that? What is there in the agency regulations that indicates that there is a more rigorous examination under BTA than the other standards?
Well, to be clear, the agency does not think, and therefore did not in its regulation presume, that the best technology available for minimizing adverse environmental impact was more strict than the other standards. And just two common sense points on that. The pollutant discharge standards, which are the other ones, establish their goal to be the elimination of discharges, whereas here this provision says that its goal is to minimize. So on its face, this is a more measured standard than the others. And second, as a practical matter, there's no reason Congress would want greater protection for fish through intake structures than for people through the discharge of pollutants. I mean, especially, Congress enacted all of these provisions in 1972, and it provided at that time that in determining pollution discharge, even including toxic pollution discharge, EPA was required to consider the relationship between costs and benefits up until 1989. And it makes no sense to think that Congress would have wanted stricter standards for fish here than for people under the toxic discharge provisions. And on its face —
Are you disagreeing with the premise of Justice Kennedy's question?
Yes. Our argument is that this provision here for water intake
— a tougher standard. You do not think Congress intended a tougher standard. Is that your point?
We think Congress did not intend this to be a tougher standard than the ones for —
Why didn't it use BPT or one of the other standards?
Well, because these are all different standards. Two things are for certain. One is that this standard is
different
from all of the others.
One, then it's either less rigorous or more rigorous.
Right. But there's no reason to presume that this one is more rigorous, especially considering — first, I mean, the words here — it uses important words here it did not use elsewhere. Here we have best technology available for minimizing adverse environmental impact. And first, best, as some of the examples earlier demonstrated, is not necessarily the way that most single-mindedly pursues a goal at all costs and without regard to all of the consequences. Which is why, for example, if I was talking about the best way to get home, it would not necessarily be the most direct route if that required payment of a toll. Similarly, minimize is also an important — and again, Congress used best to mean that in best conventional pollutant control technology, because that's the only word there that's amenable to our reading. And second, minimize is also an important word, because minimize has two perfectly common ordinary meanings. One is to reduce to the greatest extent possible. The other, in ordinary usage, is to reduce to some lesser reasonable level. So if I said, for example, that I was trying to minimize the risk of being hit by a car today, I presumably would not mean that I was staying inside at home all the time. Instead, it would mean that consistent with other needs, including economic ones like the need to travel to work,
so it would,
I was being prudent.
If it said available to reduce, for minimizing is no stronger than if it had said available. If it meant what you suggest, why didn't it read available to reduce?
Well, elsewhere in the Clean Water Act, Congress clearly did use minimize to mean reduction, because Congress called for a, quote, drastic minimization of paperwork. That's in 33 U.S. Code 1251F. And in drastic minimization has to mean a drastic reduction, which is a perfectly ordinary meaning of the word. Available is also relevant because, Justice Ginsburg, as you mentioned earlier,
reduce in any event is not the same as what you're arguing. You're arguing reduce to the maximum extent reasonably possible. The word reduce alone doesn't convey that. The word reduce would just mean, you know, if you knock it down any amount, you have reduced it. But you're saying minimize requires more than that. It means reducing it to the maximum extent reasonably possible. Isn't that what you're saying?
No, we construe, I think our the other side might take that view of minimize. Our view is that minimize means to reduce. I mean,
just to reduce.
Refers to a reasonable reduction. And so some minimal reduction in this context would probably not be reasonable.
I didn't understand that to be your position. You don't think that minimize even means that you reduce it to the maximum extent reasonably possible?
Well, I guess
any reduction constitutes minimizing.
No, because it does have to be a reasonable reduction, which would not be, in this context, would not be a trivial one. Reasonableness, we may agree, depending on what one means by reasonable. Reasonableness tends to connote a consideration of all relevant factors.
Yes.
When we're talking about a reasonable reduction, we're going to talk about a reduction that's reasonable in light of, among other things, the relationship between costs and benefits. So we may agree if that's what we both mean by reasonable.
Let me say it again, and you tell me whether you agree. I had thought that what you meant, the meaning of minimize was, is that you reduce the harm to the maximum extent reasonably possible, not merely that you reduce it to some extent.
I think that's right, with reasonably entailing a consideration of the relationship between costs and benefits.
Of course. Reasonable includes everything.
Yes. And if I could reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I'd like to start with just setting the stage here. For almost 30 years now, the executive branch has had an executive order through all administrations that requires a cost-benefit analysis to be done whenever regulations are adopted. And that's because the executive branch considers that to be just an essential component of reasoned decision-making. So this Court should not be quick to conclude that Congress intended to deprive the agency of the tools that it needs to come up with reasoned answers to these vexing problems.
Do you agree this is a Chevron case?
Well, it is a Chevron case, Your Honor. We certainly think it could be resolved under Step 1, meaning the following. Can you read the statute reasonably to say that Congress unambiguously foreclosed cost-benefit analysis under 316B? I think the answer to that is no.
Well, the one question I have in this is if I look at the two standards, and the first one, the best practical, it talks about cost-benefit. It says you shall consider the total cost of application of technology in relation to the affluent reduction benefits. Then you look best available, and they've changed the phrase. It doesn't get rid of costs, but it simply says you shall take into account the cost of achieving such affluent reduction.
Your Honor, but that's...
So they both use the word cost.
They do.
And you look at what Senator Muskie said at the time.
Yes.
And what Senator Muskie said at the time is the object here is when we move to better technology, when you get past the practical and you get into the other, it says... Stop considering costs. Not quite. He says while costs should be a factor in the administrator's judgment. So he's not against using costs. He says, but if you have to do it under a reasonableness standard where you're taking into account all the goals and so forth. Now, that's ambiguous. But as I read it, it says, of course you can't avoid taking into account costs, but don't do it too much. And therefore, you'd say, don't apply one of these big formal things when you reach your final goal. There are other ways of getting there. Of course, see that it isn't absurd. And for 30 years, the agency's had a way. It's talked about grossly disproportionate. Now, that's the whole background to the question. My question is, of course, why not let sleeping dogs lie? Let the agency take into account the way it's done it to prevent absurd results. But not try to do it so that it's so refined you can't even take account of what a fish is worth unless they happen to be one of the 1.2% that goes to market.
Oh, Your Honor, we are arguing that you have to do monetized cost-benefit analysis, nor did the agency say that it was basing its
rule. Okay, fine. Then what are you arguing? Are you arguing that you should take costs into account? Because I don't think you should, reach much disagreement on that point. that sometimes you take them into account,
well,
the way that Senator Muskie suggested.
But, Your Honor, the Second Circuit held, and respondents argue, that the benefits have to be essentially the same before you can look at the cost of the technology.
Now, what they're going to argue, I guess, is going to be up to them, and I'd be very interested in hearing it.
But that's what the Second Circuit held.
All right, then you would be satisfied with the following ruling. The Second Circuit went too far in saying that you can never take costs into account.
Well, Your Honor,
of course you can sometimes take account of them. And the standard that we think is there, I'm just imagining this, is the one they've used for 30 years. Is it grossly disproportionate? Is it feasible? Is it practical? Are you using costs along with other things? How do you feel about some slightly vague thing like
that? Well, something like that, as long as it's clear that
right, so you're happy with
can
that.
Be, well, as long as costs can be compared to benefits, and the Second Circuit said they could not be, that the benefits have to be essentially the same. That's what cost-effectiveness analysis means. Of course, the statute doesn't say cost-effectiveness.
All right, so it is simply saying the Second Circuit was wrong. The use of the word cost is meaningless. Without some idea
of comparison,
of what the costs are relevant to you, but a vague, grossly disproportionate test is okay with you.
Well,
is it or not?
Vague, grossly disproportionate.
One they've used for 30 years at EPA.
Your Honor,
is that all right
think,
or not
I think
all right?
The point is, yes, if for 30 years they have not been mandating closed cycle cooling under that standard. So from the industry's perspective, that probably is an acceptable standard. But the real point here is that when we start talking about what degree can you compare the costs? Is it significantly greater than? Is it wholly disproportionate? That's exactly where Chevron comes in. If everyone concludes that you can compare costs to benefits, then certainly the agency should have some flexibility. With respect to the question of whether it should be the same standard as what I think you're referring to as the VAT standard, which governs discharges of even toxic pollutants, I think the answer to that is that not necessarily by any means, because the acronyms are similar, but the text isn't. That standard actually talks about the goal of eliminating discharges. Congress did not say eliminate all impingement and entrainment. To the contrary, they could have. They didn't. They said minimize adverse environmental impact, which is necessarily a broad delegation of discretion to the agency. In addition, that standard —
Ms. Mahoney, before you go further, I'm not clear. I did not understand that for 30 years — the only test has been a grossly disproportionate test. You seem to accept that as
wholly disproportionate, Your Honor, has been the test. That's what's been used.
Wholly disproportionate.
Wholly disproportionate, not grossly disproportionate.
And you're happy with that.
Well, the point is that I think what I'm happy with is saying that the agency should have discretion to formulate what test it's going to use, but under the wholly disproportionate test.
Okay, you think they can use a wholly disproportionate.
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
And you'd be happy if they continue to do that. But you wouldn't be particularly happy if we prescribed that as the only available test? Is that?
Well, I just think that it's hard to get that out of the language. When it doesn't come straight out of the language, wholly disproportionate, then you ought to leave it to the agency.
Could the agency mandate a closed cycle system, recirculating system?
Well, they haven't.
For old plants? Could they, under your view, the agency, given its Chevron latitude, mandate closed circulation?
Under a wholly disproportionate standard, Your Honor?
No, just under the statute.
Under the statute, I doubt it. It would probably be arbitrary and capricious. But let me explain why. The statute talks about minimizing adverse environmental impact. And it's important to understand what the EPA did here. At page 169A of the appendix, they say, we are using impingement and entrainment as a quick and convenient metric. In other words, we're going to make you reduce impingement and entrainment to a very large extent, get it down, you know, close to zero if we can, whatever. But that's not because it is itself adverse environmental impact. They say they didn't define it at 287A.
But it seems to me, of course, there are limits on what the agency can do, but if it couldn't mandate the closed circulation system, I think I've got the term right, if it could not do that, then this is not you're backing away from Chevron.
Well, here's how I would say it, Your Honor. There may be some locations where that, where it would not be wholly disproportionate. If for some reason you couldn't design an alternative system that would protect, for instance, a balanced population of fish in that water body, then it might be that closed cycle cooling would be required. But on a national basis, at 355A, the agency said that they understood that reducing impingement and entrainment at the ranges they were talking about would not be justified in many locations across the country. And that's because power plants may be impinging numbers of fish that aren't actually harming that water body. Fish have the potential to procreate in very substantial numbers. Some fish spawn 500,000 eggs in a year. And so if the — and throughout the Act, even under 316A, for instance, Congress has said that even with respect to thermal discharges, you can get variances if you can show that you're not harming a balanced population of fish in the water body. So given that, given the variances throughout the Act and even, you know, these kinds of limits on the discharge standards, which are designed to protect human health, why would you read the mandate for the maximum technology on intake structures, which has nothing to do with human health? Nothing. It is just to protect fish in the water body. So it doesn't make sense that in a single sentence added in conference in a voluminous act about discharges of pollutants that Congress would mandate the maximum technology.
Why didn't they use the word cost?
Because, Your Honor, I don't —
I mean, your argument is they use cost here, they use cost there, they didn't use cost here, but they must have meant cost.
Here's why, Your Honor. Because the most significant comparison between this statutory section and the others is they didn't list any of the factors. All of the other sections have a detailed list of considerations that the agency must take into account. This one says nothing. This is not an example
of — And maybe the inference to be drawn is the agency is not supposed to be taking any of these considerations into account.
I don't think that's the most reasonable inference because it would lead to very irrational results. 200-foot cooling towers in historic old town.
You've got the — I mean, everybody agrees that there is kind of an ultimate irrationality standard here. So that's not — that kind of a horrible is not really to the point.
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor. I don't know where in the language you can get allowance to take into account things like energy impacts. Why? If Congress gave a complete and full standard, why can we take into account aesthetic harm, navigational harm, energy impacts? It doesn't allow for that, and I think it doesn't allow for that because Congress intended the agency to define the terms in a reasonable way.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Lazarus.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. In Section 316B, Congress did not authorize EPA to decide that the benefits of minimizing adverse environmental impact did not justify the cost of available technology.
Except you say, when it's grossly disproportionate.
No,
where do you find that, or the Second Circuit said anyway?
No, let me explain our position, Your Honor. EPA has no authority in any circumstance to decide that fish aren't worth a certain amount of cost. So EPA never has the authority in any context to weigh costs against benefits. The reason why we think that would not lead to the kind of absurd circumstances they're suggesting is not because Congress has that EPA has that authority. It's because we don't think that those kinds of absurd circumstances would result from the cost-benefit balance mandated by Congress. And let me explain why. Because there are three safeguards in the statutory language, its plain meaning, which would guard against any possibility that a regulated facility would have to spend millions or hundreds of millions or billions of dollars to protect just a few fish. That would never happen. I mean, it would never happen, but not because EPA can decide it's not worth it. This is why it would never happen. Three reasons, and these are contributing reasons. The first reason is if you actually had some exorbitant, huge increase in cost, if that would happen, most of those cases would be triggered by the availability requirement, and that is that EPA could deem that cost not to be reasonably borne by the industry. That's the ground they
require. I don't want to interrupt your enumeration of three reasons, but I just don't see how you get cost into the concept of availability. Yeah. They, it doesn't fit in there any better than it does under best.
No, I think it fits quite well in the word available. And EPA has said that since 1976. It was not disputed by anyone that available.
It's not the plain meaning of the word. If I look in the real estate page of the Washington Post on Sunday and I look for the best house that is available, the best house that is available might cost $50 million. Now, that would be available to me. I couldn't afford it, but it would be available. So I just don't see how cost can be fit into that concept of availability.
I think because it's clear that in the context of the Clean Water Act, what Congress meant in available, and this is throughout the statute, all the technology-based performance standards, the availability was both technologically available and economically available. And that's just not disputed.
You're using the word in a strange, economically available? Economically feasible, maybe, but you wouldn't say economically available. You wouldn't say, I can't buy the house because for me it's not economically available. I might say it's not economically feasible, it's not economically possible, but it's not economically available. That's weird.
It may be weird, Your Honor, but it is not anything that's ever been disputed in interpretation of the Water Act. It's how EPA has interpreted it for 30 years. And no court, no one has ever disputed the fact that availability includes economic availability.
If availability includes economic availability, why doesn't best include economically best?
Because what the statute says is not that EPA should promulgate the best technology. It says the best technology available for minimizing. And what Congress did was told EPA what the technology must be best for. And that's not reducing it to the amount that EPA believes is sensible. It means minimizing it,
But that doesn't answer, it seems to me, the question. Yeah, the best available for that purpose. But what is best for that purpose could include other factors such as how expensive is it and how much it harms the industry and all sorts of things.
No, it certainly includes cost, and it certainly includes sort of whether it can be reasonably borne by the industry.
I don't know how you draw the lines you're drawing. You say, yes, best includes whether it would bankrupt the industry. Well, if it includes whether it would bankrupt the industry, why shouldn't it include whether it would bankrupt the individual power company?
Well, there's no question, Your Honor, that the word available, and perhaps the word best, we think the word available, includes an inquiry into whether or not it can be borne by the industry. We also wouldn't doubt, Your Honor. We wouldn't doubt that.
I agree with you on that, whether it's borne by the industry, but you draw the line there.
No.
Where that line is drawn up to the agency?
Well, we're not, Your Honor. And let me try to explain, because I think we're confusing different inquiries here.
Okay.
We also would agree that EPA can take into account site-specific factors in deciding whether technology is available. Some technology will be available for some facilities given their location, but not available for other facilities given their location. But where EPA decides whether technology is available or not, we don't doubt they have authority to do that and some discretion to decide when technology is no longer available because of the cost.
Isn't that exactly what they did here in listing a suite of technologies or approaches that is available? I thought that was exactly what they did. They said for different locations, different technologies may be the best available.
All right, and that is perfectly appropriate. But here's what they did, which is not permitted. They can decide based on site-specific factors whether technology is available. What they can't do is once they decide the technology is available, they can't then say, but we don't think it's worth minimizing the adverse environmental impact with that technology because we don't think those benefits are worth that cost. That comparison inquiry they can't make. So if I can do my safeguards, the first one is we think availability and cost would eliminate a lot of those problems. But let's just assume the technology is much more expensive, right, way more expensive, but it's still available in our view. It still can be borne by the industry, even on a site-specific basis, which we don't disagree that can be done. Then let's say that the national EPA says, well, but that will only save your cheaper technology will only save 1 million fish. We actually think you have to save 1,000,001 fish.
I don't see how you can do that. I just don't see it. Suppose that the cost of this machine is $100,000. Now, if you say, I'm talking about using that machine for an entire industry, you'd say, my God, that's certainly available. You say, but here I have this one part of the industry here. I have a little plant. and, you know, to hook that machine up, it's only going to save one paramecium. Neither of us wants that. And so the logical thing to say is to say, well, it isn't available for that. And I would be with you there.
No, but
to be honest about it, I'd have to say the reason it isn't available is quite — it isn't available for minimizing the harm, that particular adverse impact, which is killing a water animal. The reason it isn't is because it doesn't kill any water animals. Well, let me be honest. It kills one. Or kills two, or kills three, and don't tell me de minimis, because as soon as you say de minimis, I'm going to add one, okay? But what I'm trying to show here is that there it isn't meaningful to talk about cost being available for an end about something not being available for an end in light of its cost, unless you take into account what that end is. I mean, we'd spend trillions to make the America secure so not 50,000 people die. But we won't spend trillions for a road accident. And of course you take those things into account. So that's exactly the point I wonder about. Are you really saying, pay no attention, or are you saying, which I could understand better, but you have to say what you want. I mean, that what we mean is, yes, they can take costs into account. That's what they do under the comparable standard, best available technology, but just use your head. Don't do it too much. Don't use it, like, take other things into account, too. Don't do a formal cost-benefit analysis. Don't try to evaluate the paramecium. Do the difference between the two standards, best practical, best available.
It is
grossly or wholly or something.
But for best available, there is no cost-benefit analysis. It's only for best practice.
But best available says take costs into account.
Right.
Now, there's a way of doing that, which is what I'd call a common-sense way that they have some discretion over that doesn't involve some enormously elaborate thing. And that's what I'm searching for. I'm not sitting here with an answer.
Right.
I'm trying to find a way of making sense of this.
Well, let me try to give you an answer. They can consider costs only in a cost feasibility perspective. They cannot compare cost to benefits. Congress may —
those two things seem contrary to me. I don't see how you could — you say why?
No, I don't, because they're two fundamentally different policy decisions. What Congress decided in 1972 was that EPA should be allowed to consider cost in determining whether technology was available, but not — and they did this for a reason, Your Honor — but not to weigh those costs against those benefits and deciding whether or not those costs were worth it.
How is it feasible if it has no benefits at all?
It's still feasible for in terms of whether they can afford it.
And we're going to reach our insane results.
You're never going to reach the insane result. It's never going to happen, Your Honor. It's never going to happen. Put aside the availability limitation, which will cut off like it did dry cooling. EPA rejected it, saying it's too expensive. Not because the cost benefit is too expensive. If you actually have something where one would just be saving a few fish, what you have to remember is that 316B doesn't impose technology design requirements. What it imposes is technology-based performance standards. And if EPA were to say you have to save just a few more fish, if they really were to promulgate a standard on that kind of increment, the regulated facility would always be able to save just a small increment without adopting some expensive technology because of the way cooling water intake structures work.
Counsel, your argument is focused on proving that your interpretation won't lead to insane results, as you put it. But you've got to do a lot more than that. I mean, you have to establish that this is not ambiguous language.
Well, I think it's not ambiguous language because if you look at the statutory language, it says, right, in Section 316B, EPA is required, right, instructed to require the location, design, construction, capacity of cooling water intake structures reflect the best technology available for minimizing adverse environmental impact. And what we argue, and I think this is quite compelling, Your Honor, is that with that language, Congress itself struck the cost-benefit balance. Congress said, for costs, EPA has to ensure the technology be available, either on an industry-wide and can take into account site-specific factors. For benefits, Congress said, EPA, you have to ensure that the environmental benefits, the adverse environmental impact, be minimized to the extent that can be done with available technology.
Well, you have a good argument based on the language of the statute, I think, that cost cannot be taken into account at all. But once you concede that it can be taken into account at all, then I don't see why you're not in Chevron Step 2.
Well, Your Honor, there's a
word. What's in the door? I don't see how you.
No, it's a complete line. Whether the word available can extend to cost feasibility analysis is one question. Whether the word available can allow EPA to compare costs and benefits to weigh one against the other, that's a completely different question. So the fact that we say the first can happen doesn't mean the second. Congress really had what they were doing in 1972 was Congress was
concerned. Our problem is that we — you've got a clear distinction in mind, and I don't think we're getting the distinction. Is the distinction in crude terms this? They can consider cost in the sense that on an industry-wide basis, they can ask, is there money in the bank or will there be money in the bank to pay for this? They don't ask cost benefit in the sense of asking, is the money in the bank worth what they're going to get for it? So is the line you're drawing a money in the bank line? Is that the point you're making?
They can't make the judgment that it's not worth it.
But
for the reasons that you suggest.
But is the only question when you say they can consider cost, are you saying they are simply asking whether it is economically possible for the industry to afford this, regardless of whether it's any good or not?
Absolutely.
Is it good? Is that your
point? Absolutely. Okay. And what, in 1972, this is what Congress was facing.
When you say whether the industry can afford it, does that take into account at all the effect on the price that consumers have to pay? If the effect of achieving a very small gain in protecting fish is to increase electricity costs 10 times, that's something that cannot be taken into account.
Now, if it can be reasonably borne by the industry or some site-specific, they can't make any other judgment. And if I can, Your Honor.
They can't make any other judgment. So imagine the consequence of that environmentally. They can't make any other judgment. Suppose the EPA is right. It's going to add 20 electric plants, huge plants, purely to save the fish. And the result is the cost of electricity goes up, and the result is there are no electric cars because people make the comparison with oil, and now they have to have petrol. I mean, it's very hard for me to believe that Senator Muskie would have written a statute that would have foreseen such an effect.
Right. I think because such an effect wouldn't happen. What Senator Muskie and Congress was worried about in 1972, Your Honor, was they were worried about the possible underregulation. They worried about overregulation. And their concern was if you gave EPA the authority to weigh costs against benefits, you would have systematic underregulation and the regulatory process bogged down by
That's exactly where I agree with you. So I go back to page 170 of the legislative history, which I've read now six times. And I agree with you that it is not totally clear. Maybe you think it is. But it seemed to me what he's saying there is just what you've said. Don't go into this with some elaborate thing. But remember, costs are still relevant. And what I've been searching for throughout is a set of words that would help me translate that thought into a legal reality.
And going back to Justice Souter's statement a moment ago, which I agree with, what Senator Muskie, the distinction he wanted to draw, was to allow EPA to engage in cost analysis in terms of feasibility, money in the bank, but not to make that value judgment of what's worth what.
Well, if you get to that money in the bank, does this mean that best technology available changes over time? I mean, maybe the industry could have borne these costs 2 years ago, but they probably can't today. Nobody has money in the bank today.
Right. It certainly does depend, and this is how EPA does it, and not just in this area, but throughout all the technology-based performance standards, looking at availability, EPA looks at industry revenues, barriers to entry, and decides whether or not this technology is available.
So you think they could have said 2 years ago, this is what you have to do. But today they would say, you don't have to do that anymore.
It's quite
possible. Even though the technology is still available.
Well, but notice, not economically, notice in this case, what the Second Circuit said in remanding was that EPA might well be able to justify the same decision it made on an availability basis, but they didn't make that determination here. What's happened for the past 30 years, which is how my counsel over here postured the case, what's happened over the last 30 years is that EPA has ignored the statutory language, and they've engaged in this wholly disproportionate analysis as a result, which has led to the very kind of underregulation that Senator Muskie was worried about, and that is that they have never looked to see whether closed-cycle cooling is, in fact, available economically available. Instead, they've tried to compare these things. They've just kept on going with one through cycle cooling. They've never given a serious look at closed cycle cooling. And the kind of increment we're talking about, if they actually looked at closed cycle cooling, if they make availability determination, we're not talking about an increment. It's a 98% reduction in the water flow that happens if you go
from one cycle. May I ask you this question? It's not economically available if it will bankrupt the whole industry.
That's right.
What about if it bankrupts three firms?
If it bankrupts three firms, if one looks at how EPA has interpreted that historically, Your Honor, in all throughout all the pollution control statutes, the Air Act, the Water Act, the Resource Conservation Act, EPA has said that itself isn't enough to say it's not available for the industry. But it is possible. We don't doubt this. It is possible.
But it's not economically available to those three firms.
No, but here's what happens. What EPA has said, and you can see this in this Court's decision in the Crush Stone case, where the Court drew this distinction. A particular facility can seek a variance based on cost impact to them if they can show that the cost to them is much greater because of some particular circumstances to them than it is for the industry as a whole. This Court said they could do that. EPA has long said it. We don't question it, that they can do a cost.
No, but they're just not quite as strong a company.
Yeah,
but
no. And that's the very distinction this Court drew in the Crush Stone
case.
But
is the variance a matter of statutory right or is it available under a regulation?
The way this Court interpreted sort of the use of categorical standards in the DuPont case early on in the 1970s, the Court said in that case that EPA can promulgate these kinds of technology-based performance standards on a categorical basis.
Yeah.
But if they do so, they have to give a variance possibility. Because if a particular
why isn't that simply another name for cost-benefit analysis?
Because you can't do it on a cost-benefit. It's not a cost-benefit variance.
Well, you are doing on cost-benefit. You're saying no. if we require this and the company goes bankrupt, the value of demanding it is not satisfied by the result.
No, that's not the justification for the cost variance. The justification of the cost variance is not because of the sort of benefits being lost. It's because if you can show, this is the only basis you can get a cost variance, and this is an important distinction, but not an easy one. The only way you can get a variance is if you can show that the assumptions EPA made about how much this would cost don't apply to you. Because there's something different about your facility. So actually it would cost you much more. You can get a variance for that. You can't get a variance because you say we're a weak company and our revenues aren't strong. You can't get a variance for that.
And I assume you can't get a variance, and you also would say the EPA cannot take it into account if this particular plant, although the company as a whole is quite prosperous, this is a small plant and it's not generating that much electricity. It's really just not worth it to put in this big tower. We're going to close down.
That
would not be something that EPA could take into account.
The EPA can take into account, as they do for all technology-based performance standards, they can take out size of facility to the extent that it bears on the availability question. They can't do it because they think it's not worth it in terms of the benefits over here. They can take into account on availability, but not over here.
So what about the particular case? What they said here is that if you require the closed circuit for everybody, we're going to pay an energy penalty of 2.4 to 5.3%. You'll have to build 20 additional 400 megawatt plants, which is huge, many, many, many billions of dollars. Just to replace the capacity you've lost, and the result, which seems quite logical, would be to increase by a lot, not just a little, the consumption of fossil fuel. Well, now how are they not — you seem to be arguing that they can't take that into account, which for an environmental agency, I would have thought, but they must take it into account.
We're not saying they can't take that into account. EPA has said they can. The Second Circuit said they could, and we agree. But here's how they can take into account. They can take into account in deciding what will be necessary to minimize adverse environmental impact. So they can take into account those things in deciding whether or not —
So if they did exactly the same thing they've done, which I've just read you, and they put a label on it. Instead of saying thinking of benefits, we're calling it now taking into account environmental impacts, then they could do it.
Well, but here's what they can do, Your Honor, and I don't think there's anything anomalous about this. EPA can say, here are the factors we're going to take into account in deciding whether or not we're minimizing adverse environmental impact. and we have some authority to decide what is and is not a relevant environmental impact. Here are the things we're going to take account in deciding whether or not this technology and its cost makes it available or not. They have some authority here, but once they decide whether the technology is available, once they decide what environmental impact means and what it means to minimize, once they decided that, they can't then say, well, we don't think these impacts are worth those costs.
I see that thought, and this is what's concerning me, but there may be a very good answer. A lot remains to be done with EPA. They have an enormous job to do, and I wouldn't want to get them tied up in unnecessary red tape where everybody is suddenly taking them to court on rather technical things. So if this grossly or wholly or whatever you call it, read it out of the Muskie one page 170. Read it out of the available technology definition. You can take costs into account. Just don't do it in this other way. I can see how they could work with that.
Right.
Now, I'm worried about what you're saying that may make it so difficult for them that they won't be able to do the job.
We're doing the exact opposite, Your Honor. What we're trying to do is say that the information EPA has to focus on, the way Congress constrained them, is limited, and it doesn't allow them to weigh one against the other. What happens if, and this is why Congress didn't want to give EPA cost-benefit analysis authority here or most anywhere in this statute, Congress was concerned that it would bog down the regulatory process. And that is that if you actually had EPA have to come up to this weighing of one to the other and try to weigh these imponderables, they would be subject to such extraordinary attack, as happened in this case with this rulemaking, that it would slow down the decision-making process. It wouldn't speed it up. Congress understood that information is not costless. And sometimes one can achieve a better cost-benefit balance by having regulation be based on less information rather than more information. And that's why they said, we want to take out this particular. Remember, before 1972, there was cost-benefit analysis based upon assessment of water quality impacts. And Congress saw what happened with that. It completely paralyzed the regulatory decision-making process. You end up with very little regulation. So they simply said, all right, we think EPA can do cost feasibility analysis well. We don't think they can do cost-benefit analysis well. We think the kind of information is several orders of magnitude greater and more imponderable. And it's
Is the reason they don't do cost-benefit analysis well because they are forced to do it in a political atmosphere in which it is difficult to make rational decisions? Is that basically the reason Congress would have come to that conclusion?
I think that may be part, but I don't think that's you're going to see that's the real reason in 1972. I think that does happen. I think the real reason in 1972 was that Congress saw what happened before, and they said it turns out to be really hard in the water quality context to measure and value environmental impact. It's so hard that we think that EPA can get a better, more rational result if we instead say, here's what you focus on. Technology available, minimizing, and
but
don't
I
try
think
to compare.
I see your point, but I think if I accept your point, all I'm doing is saying they may, in a kind of smoke and mirrors way, take cost-benefit analysis into consideration sub rosa when they decide what availability is going to mean. And they may take it into consideration when they decide what an undesirable environmental impact is. And that sort of gets the weighing process out of the public focus. And if they do it that way, they can bring in just the considerations that Justice Breyer is talking about, but they don't do it in an obvious way. And I think that's what your argument boils down to.
Well, I think our argument boils down to that they can focus on environmental impacts, define what is and isn't an environmental impact. They can focus on availability, decide what costs are relevant to that and when the technology is
not
available.
What costs
they
are relevant to that?
What? Yeah, they're relevant.
And when they make that decision, are they not in effect anticipating the kind of decision that they would make on a more specific basis in a more highly charged political atmosphere if they engaged in the cost-benefit of analysis that you say they can't do?
It may well be one reason why Congress didn't want to compare one to the other about that charged atmosphere, but what they can't do it. I don't think they're doing it sub rosa. Well, our point is, Your Honor, that if they do it according to Congress's instruction, you won't have these kinds of absurd
and results. the page of the legislative history or the page of the text of the statute that says what I think is try it with your son. It costs $100.
Sorry, I couldn't quite hear.
Your son says it costs $100. You say that's too expensive. He says, but I didn't tell you what it was for. What? I mean, you see, now you tell me the state, the page, and I've read a lot of it. Tell me the page of the legislative history or the phrase of the statute where it says what you just said, that you cannot take into account what you're buying for that $100.
Right.
What page? What? I'll read it again.
Well, I'm not going to give you a specific page. I'm going to give you the statutory language of Section 316B.
Right. I know 316.
And what Congress was doing systematically in 316B and throughout the Clean Water Act was that Congress was saying, we want to give EPA the authority to cost feasibility. We don't believe in this, that it works to do cost-benefit analysis because of the weighing against one against the other.
Well, it has required, not just permitted, but required cost-benefit analysis in other areas. What is your response to the fact that it seems ridiculous to allow it and indeed require it in effluent situations where human health is at stake, and yet to forbid it in this intake situation when you're just talking about the snail darter? What's your response to that?
Two responses, Your Honor. The first is that in 1972, which is when 316B was enacted, Congress did not allow cost-benefit analysis for toxic pollutants. Toxic pollutants were not regulated under Section 301 and 304 of the statute. They were not subject to best practical control technology. They were not subject to best available technology. They were subject to a separate provision, and that is Section 307 at that time. That's a subsequent amendment to the law, where Congress originally...
And did that Section 307 not allow cost-benefit?
Did not allow cost-benefit. The way Congress originally approached hazardous water pollutants and toxic air pollutants, the Clean Air Act was the same. They said, EPA, this is so harmful that we actually want you to do an assessment to figure out at what level will it no longer be harmful to humans. And what they found out when they tried that is they found out, boy, that information is unbelievably hard to come up with. And so they had the regulation depend on this incredible information, and the result was that EPA did nothing. They did nothing for water toxics. They did nothing for air toxics. So in 1977, when they learned how more information-based regulation could lead to less regulation, they said, all right, we've got to change that. That doesn't work. So we're going to move to a technology-based performance approach in the first instance, and then couple it with still keeping the health base as a backup to be able to go past that. So they put the technology base as a first step, and they kept the 307. But in 1972, Your Honor, there was only one provision of the Clean Water Act in which Congress delegated any authority to EPA to compare costs and benefits, and that was under 301B2 and 304B2. And in that provision, they said, until 1977 only, EPA, for best practical control technology, you can and you must do cost-benefit analysis.
Counsel,
but that's the only provision.
You'd have to agree, wouldn't you, that the panel's decision in this case overruled the prior panel's decision in Judge Katzmann's opinion in Riverkeeper 1?
No, they certainly didn't overrule it for two different reasons. If you look at the Riverkeeper 2 opinion, I think it's on 25A, note 11, they explain that in Riverkeeper 1, dry cooling was rejected because it was too expensive. That's an availability consideration, not a cost-benefit consideration.
Well, in Riverkeeper 1, what Judge Katzmann said is that we think the EPA was permitted to consider cost and energy efficiency in determining the best technology available. So he was deciding it on the basis of availability.
He gave several reasons, Your Honor. Also included was the fact that it was too expensive, which is why the Riverkeeper 2 court characterized that as dictum. In all events, with all due respect to my former colleague in the Georgetown faculty, Judge Katzmann was wrong.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Josepher, you have 4 minutes remaining.
Thank you. If I could start where we left off. I mean, the fact that Riverkeeper 1, in their view, is wrong, I think does confirm what anyone would conclude after reading the two opinions, which is that they're not consistent. And at a minimum, that helps to demonstrate ambiguity.
It was an ambiguity the government said it could live with. Now, the government advised this court not to grant cert in this case. Isn't that so?
Yeah, what we said is we thought the Court of Appeals was dead wrong, that it was a very important issue, but that in the interlocutory posture of this case, which was a remand, we did not think that it was so important as to warrant your cert standards. Frankly, we were delighted to find out we were wrong about that. The other point I need to make is that this case is, after all, about the one sentence in the Act that deals with water intake. not about all the other detailed provisions about the discharge of pollutants, which is important because about half of the last argument dealt with the discharge of pollutants. The fact that there's no list of factors here, and instead just one general sentence, just underscores that on this issue, Congress was delegating especially broad authority to the agency to address a problem that at the time was relatively novel and that the legislative record confirms Congress itself did not give any real weight to. If we want to look to floor statements, though, I would look not to the floor statement of Congressman Muskie concerning a different standard, which was the BAT standard, but instead to the only floor statement that addresses this standard. And it says that economic practicability is the test, and everyone agrees that practicability considers cost.
Well, that was the House side, which the House side was against that. And the question I have from your point of view is the obverse question. If you look at this particular cost-benefit analysis, I mean, it goes through all these things, which they don't know what the numbers are. Nobody knows what the values of the fishes are, which 98% are never even eaten. They're fast swimmers or whatever. But the you see the point here. All of his fears, your opponent, brother here, seem to be manifest in this kind of a document, which if you do read Senator Muskie, seems to be the very thing he was against. So what is — I'm still left with your suggestion of what to do other than just, well, it's all fine.
No, well, look, first off, what EPA did here is not among the more robust forms of cost-benefit analysis, and therefore we don't think the Court necessarily needs to expand to opine on the outer limits here. EPA did two things. First, as you mentioned, first it created nationwide performance standards, and second, it did a variance when individual facilities' costs are significantly greater than the benefits. So first, in determining — the second of those is easiest, because there's an obvious thumb in the environmental side of the scales there. Costs have to be significantly greater than benefits, which is not all that aggressive. Here, with respect to the nationwide performance standards, EPA, again, did not just try to do a strict or cost, one penny greater than benefits. Instead, it weighed up a number of considerations. It looked to the incremental benefits of closed-cycle cooling versus the technologies that it chose. And then it determined that those incremental benefits were outweighed by a variety of other things, including, one, the extremely high total cost of closed-cycle cooling, $3.5 billion. Second, the cost-benefit ratio, which was extremely disproportionate. Third, the energy impacts, which, as you mentioned, are really quite significant. We're talking about 40% of the nation's power supply. And if we're going to reduce that by 4% and require 20 new plants to be built and require each of these plants to be taken offline for 10 months while it's retrofitted, that's really a very significant concern of EPA's. And then the fourth is the air pollution. And so when EPA is weighing benefits against all of those other things and is not purporting to assign artificial monetary values to everything, in our view, that just underscores that we're well within the agency's discretion here. If I could also turn then to just the main point, one of the main points here is that I really don't think respondents have any logic to their position. Because when we're talking about the text, they say costs have to be considered against affordability and not against benefits. But when we're talking about absurd results, they say, oh, sure, you can consider costs against benefits when it would otherwise be absurd. But under Chevron, it's the agency's gap-filling discretion to decide where to draw that line, and nothing draws a de minimis line in the statute any more than the line EPA has drawn.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.